This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office in Chicago about a recent plea deal that his client Rozmia Odeh signed.
This is a story both hideous and uplifting. She's a real heroine. Listen in.
Eli Smith joins us to talk about a protest and performance that's coming to a large building in downtown Manhattan.
This is the creepiest building you'll ever see. It's 55 stories and has no windows. I used to practice law down there for 25 years. I never knew what was going on down there. Now I do.
We'll speak with a representative from the Center for Media and Democracy about a recent lawsuit filed against Scott Pruitt.
This is a guy, along with his boss Trump, that's declared war on the environment and humanity. Let's see what his secret emails say.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In 1969, when she was a 21-year-old college student in Ramallah, in the Israeli-occupied territories in the West Bank, Rozmia Odeh, a Palestinian woman, was arrested for killing two Israeli university students with a bomb placed in a supermarket. She confessed to the crime and served 10 years in prison, getting out in a prisoner swap. She came to the United States 20 years ago, obtained citizenship, and settled in Chicago as a community organizer of immigrant Arab women. Odeh was criminally charged 2 years ago by the federal government with unlawful procurement of naturalization. In her application for citizenship 18 years before, she omitted mention of the crime for which she was convicted in Israel. In her defense, she said that she could not remember that she had post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of being tortured in jail for 25 days and forced to sign a false confession. Her expert witness was not allowed to testify as to the PTSD and the torture. The trial judge's ruling on this was overturned by a federal court of appeals. Last week, she agreed to a plea arrangement where she would be stripped of her citizenship and deported rather than face 5 to 7 years in prison and indefinite detention by ICE. She is 69 years old and does not know where she will be sent, inasmuch as she cannot go home. We speak today with attorney Michael Deutsch, who represented Odeh. He is a partner at the People's Law Office in Chicago and a former legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Deutsch, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Tell us, why did Odeh sign a confession?
Well, she was arrested and predictably tortured for 25 days, subject to electric shock, raped by instrument, beaten, had her father brought in the cell and forced to see her father beaten. And security arrestees, they're tortured, and 99% of them confess under torture. So it wasn't a strange thing that she confessed after all that horrific torture she experienced.
And you're speaking of the Israeli government doing this to her and her father.
Yeah, the Shabak, the Israeli secret police, that even the military. She was arrested by the military, beaten even before she got to the interrogation center, and then subject to this, you know, systematic use of torture to obtain confessions and information from security detainees.
I understand that Amnesty International has reported 1,000 complaints from Palestinians of torture since 2001. Is torture an essential element of Israeli military rule?
Absolutely. It's systematic. Everybody that's arrested is tortured in some form or fashion, particularly people who are believed to be part of the resistance. This is back in 1969 when she was tortured, 1969, 1970. And it's continued on, and there's been many studies by the United Nations, by Israeli human rights groups, by independent human rights organizations that have exposed this torture, and it continues unabated.
Is sexualized torture used against women?
Absolutely, and that was what Rozmia suffered. Raped by instrument, threatened to rape, stripped nude, continually threatened with rape by other prisoners who are forcibly put in a cell with her while she's nude. It's part of their psychological torture and physical torture that has continued unabated since there was an Israel and even before there was an Israel.
Yeah, I just want to say as an aside, torture seems to be something that accompanies all imperial regimes, from Algeria, the United States and Vietnam, the United States and Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo, Israel here on the West Bank that they captured. It seems to be like a global phenomenon. But in any case, I wanted to ask you, the Israeli military courts try people in the West Bank because the military runs the West Bank. What's the conviction rate in the military courts?
It's probably over 99%. Everybody is convicted. The judges are soldiers. The prosecutors are soldiers. The interpreters are soldiers. And it's a kangaroo court. Basically, you don't have a chance. There's been no reported cases that I know of that, even though they go through this charade of saying that you can move to suppress your confession if it was the subject of torture, I know of no case in which a military court has suppressed a confession as a result of torture, even though they know very well that this is the modus operandi of the security authorities of Israel.
Michael, Odeh was labeled a terrorist, both by her detractors in Israel and also here in the United States. What is the impact of using that word?
Well, it's tremendously prejudicial, particularly if you're going to stand trial in a U.S. court. That has been their strategy from the beginning, to try and use the military court conviction in which she was convicted of in being involved in several bombings, two bombings, to discredit her. And basically, they're using the military court conviction as evidence that she was a terrorist, as if anyone who's defending their land and fighting against a foreign occupation could ever be considered a terrorist. They're usually, in the history of the world, freedom fighters. But the Israelis and the U.S., as their ally, have used any kind of resistance by Palestinians as terrorism. And this is what the whole strategy of the prosecution was and is in the Detroit federal case against her.
Do you think that Donald Trump's Islamophobia is in line with the Israeli demonization of Palestinians?
Well, yeah, it's consistent with that, but demonization of Palestinians occurred under Obama and Carter and Clinton and Bush. It's a U.S. policy as a way of justifying the occupation and taking of their land by the Israelis. So it's been U.S. policy forever since Israel got their statehood in 1948 through U.N. pressure that the U.S. manipulated and caused. And I don't think the Islamophobia of the Trump administration and Donald Trump, which is clear, is going to significantly change U.S. policy towards Israel, towards Palestine, which has been to support Israel financially, militarily, and any way possible. So it's a continuation of U.S. policy.
But do you agree with me that using the label terrorist both here and in Israel is supportive of stoking fear and demonizing whole communities? It allows for violence and repression, incarceration, bombing, deportation, spying, occupation. I mean, that seems to be the kind of world we're living in here and there.
Absolutely. And after, in the U.S., we've passed a lot of these laws which designate foreign organizations as terrorists. And, of course, five of the leading Palestinian organizations have been put on that terrorist list. If you're on that terrorist list and you give any support to one of those organizations, solidarity, learning about it, promoting people from those organizations to come to the U.S. to talk about Israel-Palestine, you can be subject to 15 years in prison for support of a terrorist organization, providing material support for a designated terrorist organization. So terrorism has been a way to demonize anyone that supports the solidarity of liberation struggles, both outside the U.S. and inside the U.S.
Attorney Michael Deutsch, what thoughts went into deciding whether to take the plea deal? You know, we got Trump now as the president. Jeff Sessions is the attorney general who runs the federal prosecutions. We've got this whole atmosphere of Islamophobia. How did these come into play when you thought about the plea deal?
Well, what happened was that she was convicted by a federal court in Detroit, and we appealed that conviction because they wouldn't let her put on her post-traumatic stress defense. She had been tortured, and that affected her answer she gave when she obtained her naturalization. So the court said she could, in fact, put on the post-traumatic stress defense. But in response to that, the government brought a superseding indictment against her, which basically changed an immigration case into a terrorism case, and basically said that she was involved in terrorist activities, which would allow them to prove up this her involvement in these alleged bombings, and that she had lied when she said she was not a member of a terrorist organization, and saying that she was a member of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which would have allowed them to put in evidence all the what they call terrorism acts of the PFLP back in 1968, 69, 70, 71, when they were fighting against the occupation of this after the 67 war. So we were now looking at a trial which was not going to be about immigration and the fact that she did not knowingly lie, but it was going to be about terrorism and to prove that she was a terrorist and she was involved with a terrorist organization. And we just felt that that was going to be a tremendously prejudicial case. They were even talking about going to the West Bank and taking the depositions of Rasmia's co-defendants in the military case in which he was convicted of being involved in bombings. And they were threatening to use all this PFLP history against her in a trial. And, of course, she had been sentenced to 18 months already, and if she was convicted, would probably get at least 18 months and maybe more. She would lose her citizenship if convicted. And even if she were acquitted in that very, very difficult case, they could still put her in denaturalization under immigration law and take her citizenship even if she had been acquitted in the criminal case in Detroit. So looking at all those factors and getting the government to agree that she would have to do no further time in federal prison and wouldn't be put in any kind of immigration detention and could essentially leave on her own free will in a very difficult decision, heart-rendering decision, she decided that she would take this plea offered by the government.
What kind of support did Rasmia have in the last 3.5 years since her arrest?
She's had incredible support. I mean, I've done these cases for over 45 years and been in courtrooms full of supporters, but her support was extraordinary because it was basically a lot of people from the community that she worked with in Chicago, Arab women, who came on buses to support her, who protested outside the courtroom, who filled the courtroom. She had become a national heroine of resistance to the occupation. She's known throughout the United States and even internationally as someone that's very well respected. And it's basically based on the work she's done for almost 20 years of working with Arab women and helping them adjust to life in the U.S. and supporting the freedom of the Palestinian people.
Now, talk more about this loss to her community, would you please?
Well, it's a tremendous loss to her community. She's an extraordinary person, unique in the sense that she's able to get the trust and support of Arab women who have come here and are living in very difficult situations. She's gone around door to door and organized women 600 women have been part of the Women's Committee of the Arab American Action Network, and people love her. They just really relate to her because they know she's honest and genuine and that she has experiences that are similar to theirs. I mean, she did 10 years in an Israeli prison. She was subject to torture. And even after that, she had to come here to help her family. Her father died of cancer, as did her brother, and then made a new life for her here. So the loss to the community is tremendous. People are very saddened by this. And as I said before, it was one of the most difficult decisions I've ever been involved in terms of whether or not to take this plea deal, because we knew that once she took it, she would be then lose her citizenship and have to be removed from the U.S.
Michael, where will she go? Can she return to her home?
Well, it's up in the air. She can go anywhere. She has a Jordanian passport, so she can go to Jordan, although there are always issues about Palestinians with Jordanian passports, how they treat them, and that's a question that we don't know the answer to. And as part of the plea agreement, it was agreed that she could go to any country that would agree to take her. So any country where she could get a visa to go, she's able to go. So these are things that are now being thought through and figured out where she will go and how she will accomplish that.
Michael, I'm sure you know that Rasmia is one of the featured speakers at the upcoming Jewish Voice for Peace conference.
Yes, I do know that.
I think that she got a lot of support from the Jewish community in the United States, the anti-Zionist Palestine and solidarity support people here, as well as from the Arab community.
Yes, because she's the kind of person that is very open and engaging. And once you meet her or hear her speak, you're drawn to her. She's just one of those unique figures that people are drawn to, whether they're Palestinian or Arab or Israelis or Jews. The people really admire her and can relate to her. So I'm not surprised that she's one of the speakers at the conference. We've had a lot of support from progressive Jewish groups and individuals throughout the campaign, throughout her resistance to this indictment.
Michael, in our few remaining minutes, on a personal note, tell us why you took this case.
Well, I took the case because I was drawn to Rasmia. I'm a very strong supporter of the rights of the Palestinian to regain their land and their homeland. I've been involved in other cases in which Palestinians have been wrongly accused as part of a whole political COINTELPRO type thing against the solidarity movement in the U.S. And I felt that she needed to have a lawyer that could relate to her struggle and her politics. I would add that, and this is not totally known, but it should be, that Rasmia was a victim of a counterintelligence program of the FBI. In 2010, the FBI raided the homes of people doing Palestine solidarity work in Chicago and in Minnesota. And as a result of that, there was a grand jury investigation. 23 people were subpoenaed to a grand jury, all refused to testify. And as of this date, you know, 7 years later, there hasn't been anybody charged with any crime. But as a result of their investigation, and one of the head executive director of the Arab American Action Network's home was raided, they found out that Rasmia, who was the deputy director, was a naturalized citizen and had been from Israel or Palestine. So they immediately contacted the Israeli government, and the Israeli government pulled out all these old documents of her conviction in the military court and her imprisonment. And that was the basis in which she was the only one that was ever charged as a result of these raids in 2010. So she was the direct victim of a counterintelligence program action by the FBI.
So that shows the collaboration between the U.S. secret police and the Israeli secret
police. Oh, yeah,
police.
Very closely. They were very on it, got all these old documents, were willing to bring people from Israel, from the military courts and security police to come testify. And there was a very close relationship between the Israelis and the U.S. government.
Yeah, Jeff Halpern, in his latest book, he thinks one of the main reasons that Israel gets so much international support is the help that it gives to other countries with respect to controlling populations. It's kind of secret police work that it's perfected.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. And even their torture strategies have been adopted by many countries. They're leading exponent of torture and ways to spy and repress movements.
Before we have to let you go, any last thoughts?
This is a very difficult struggle for the Palestinian people. They're not going to get any support, not surprisingly, from the U.S. government, particularly under this new administration. And we as Americans, Jews, and others need to step up our support for the Palestinian struggle, both here and abroad, and begin to try and educate other people about the extreme brutality and injustice of the occupation.
Thank you, Michael. You have Heidi and my great respect and support. And thank you again for being on Law and Disorder. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There's a massive 550-foot-tall gray granite and cement NSA spine hub hidden in plain sight in a windowless AT&T skyscraper in downtown Manhattan. It's known as Titan Point. At noon on April 15th, an action is planned by a group called The Quiet American. It's an arts and politics journal based in Ridgewood, Queens, New York. They will perform a rite of exorcism on the building in order to, as their press release states, to metaphysically purge the edifice of the data it hoards and to invoke a less maniacal version of citizen-government relations. The building is located at 33 Thomas Street, where the action will take place. It's a windowless monolith that people say is creepy as hell and a monument to the bottomless fear that locks us in permanent war. The building was designed to withstand a nuclear assault and sustain up to 1,500 employees working there for 2 weeks. Here to talk to us today about the action is Eli Smith, who's my son. He's a musician and an activist from Brooklyn, and he's helped organize the event. Eli Smith is also a folklorist and music producer who organizes the annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, a huge weekend music gathering now in its 9th year and coming up at the end of April.
Eli Smith, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Eli, where did you get the idea for exorcising Titan Point?
Well, when the articles came out in The Intercept about the Titan Point NSA spying facility in downtown Manhattan, it immediately gave me and my friends that are organizing this protest the idea to do an exorcism. Of course, we were familiar with the levitation and exorcism of the Pentagon that was done back in 1967. The same folks that did that, Ed Sanders and the Fugs, Allen Ginsberg and others, also did an exorcism of the grave of Joseph McCarthy around the same time. And because the NSA is sort of a metaphysical evil in a certain sense, what they're dealing with is our data, which is not a physical object. It's a metaphysical idea. We felt that it would be appropriate and also fun, but an appropriate response to mount a metaphysical protest against them.
Yeah, I always thought that monstrous building was just an AT&T building, America Telephone and Telegraph. Who broke the story about what it really is?
Well, there have been a few articles and good journalism about it over the years, but a few months ago, the brilliant investigative reporters at The Intercept came out with a really good article and also a short film about it, and they used various sources of information, including documents that were revealed by Edward Snowden, but also other public records and architectural plans. It's very interesting. Everyone should read the article that came out on The Intercept. And if you want all that information pulled together, you can visit our website about this protest action exercise, thensa.blogspot.com.
We'll link to that on lawanddisorder.org.
Eli, tell us, what kinds of activities are you planning at the exorcism action?
Well, at this exorcism protest action that we're planning, we're gonna assemble in Foley Square Saturday, April 15th at noon. Assembling in Foley Square, we'll have a procession march with music and chanting from Foley Square, the one or two blocks there to 33 Thomas Street, where the so-called Titan Point facility is located. And then we'll have some prayers and incantations, some songs and more music, a street theater piece, various bizarre rites, which we will conduct in order to metaphysically purge and purify the data which is held there at the Titan Point facility. For example, we plan to create a positive feedback loop. Principle of this is that the NSA is spying on us, so if we spy on them, for example, if you hold your smartphone up and film the building, then they're spying on you, spying on them, spying on you, spying on them, and we hope that that will create a positive feedback loop, which could theoretically cause some sort of spiritual meltdown or crisis.
What about the ostrich egg?
Of course. Well, because it is the day before Easter, and we want to celebrate fertility and the rebirth of nature, we will be possibly sacrificing one or maybe more large ostrich eggs, or perhaps just a large fake egg, a papier-mâché egg filled with personal information, all types of data. We want to give people the opportunity to present their personal data as an offering to the unholy gods, and possibly, you know, receive some sort of positive benefit by sacrificing their personal data to this terrible altar.
How does encircling the building with salt fit into your plans?
Yes, you've read the press release. It's a nice way to start a ceremony. So we will be laying a line of salt there in front of the building in order to kind of start things off right.
Heidi, you wrote the book Spying on Democracy, which has quite a lot of information on the NSA and its link to AT&T. What did you know about all of this at the time you wrote the book a few years ago, and what do you know about it now?
That was nearly 4 years ago, and at the time we knew that various government agencies were going to telecommunications companies and asking them information from Americans on their telecommunications activities. And that would include internet use as well.
And what about now?
Well, now, as Eli referenced, we know that this 55-story building houses an NSA operation that's finally geared into the entire AT&T network. And we also know the revelations that came out from Edward Snowden and our new president's rollback of privacy rights vis-a-vis these corporations.
I read Spying on Democracy, and Michael German, the former FBI agent who's now with the Brennan Center, read it. And after he read it, he wrote that unrestrained spying is inevitably used to suppress the most essential tools of democracy, the press, political activists, civil rights advocates, and conscientious insiders who blow the whistle on corporate malfeasance and government abuse. Talk to us about what Michael German had to say.
Well, I think it's taken on a new urgency, as we've seen with a wholesale onslaught by Donald Trump and his team to go after freedom of the press, a fundamental constitutional right, and really a cornerstone of democracy by using such creative terms as false news, barring journalists from press conferences, and then blaming what we traditionally have as unnamed sources being really integral to reporters' investigative work, blaming them for being disloyal and I'm sure we're going to see increased criminalization of leakers and other individuals who see wrongs being committed every day by the government and its corporate allies and want to get this information out as part of the public's right to know. We're already in perilous territory where not only are leakers going to be published, information will be secret from the government, and yet Americans' personal data is going to be exchanged loosely with the big corporations.
Well, Eli, you're coming to grips with the NSA. What do you think about all of this?
Well, I would say that that intersection of the so-called intelligence community, the thought police part of the government, intersecting there with big corporations like AT&T is very scary. And in thinking about this protest action, you know, sometimes you'll talk to people and they'll say, well, I have nothing to hide, so it doesn't matter if I'm being spied on. But I think we have to remember that when you're being watched all the time, you're never really alone. And if you're never alone, you don't have freedom of thought. If you always think that, Big Brother is watching, it completely stifles freedom of thought, and it also stifles freedom of, for example, freedom of association. So these are the fundamental things that allow us to have a functioning democracy, if we ever can have a functioning democracy. And that's why we decided to stage this protest action, this so-called exorcism, is to defend things like freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and the most basic ideas and tools of democracy.
Well, Heidi and I will be there. Give us again the details, Eli, on the April 15th action, the website, where it's going to be, so people can write this down and join us.
Well, if you'd like to join us in this bizarre exorcism ritual and protest of the NSA, please meet us at Foley Square. That's downtown where all the courts are and everything, about 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, April 15th. And then we'll have a fun march up to 33 Thomas Street, the Titan Point facility, arriving there at noon to start the exorcism ritual and to protest the NSA spy hub there at 33 Thomas Street. I'd like to say that these issues are very serious, the issue of personal privacy and mass data collection, and we decided to confront the NSA in a non-serious way with this exorcism ritual. We felt that that was a fun way to protest something that's actually very serious.
Eli, while we have you here in the studio, please tell us what you have planned for the upcoming 9th annual Brooklyn Folk Festival.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. My day job, or one of them, is producing the Brooklyn Folk Festival, which is, as you say, an annual festival. This will be our 9th year. People can check that out at brooklynfolkfest.com. We have about more than 40 different bands, workshops, film screenings, contests, including the famous banjo toss, banjo throwing competition. We have all types of different music coming to the Brooklyn Folk Festival this year. That includes blues music and jug band, old-time string bands, some great songwriters, Puerto Rican music, Irish, Indian, French, Turkish, Balkan music, Native American music, and a whole lot more. So it should be quite a festival this year.
Eli, I understand this year more than ever there will be significant political performances. Tell us about those.
Yes, that's very relevant. We wanted to have a strong progressive political message and presentation at the Brooklyn Folk Festival this year. So we'll have a very nice topical political protest songs performance and workshop, as well as performances from Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir, and from a band called The Last Poets, which some people may be familiar with, but other people might not have heard of. In some ways, they, quote, invented rap back in the 1960s. They're really amazing poets who started performing their poetry with a band, with a rhythm section, going all the way back to the 1960s, and they don't play a whole lot of shows anymore. So if you want to catch the Last Poets, please come out to the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
I was there last year. The music was terrific. And I see that you've brought a CD of some of the highlights from last year. Will you pick out a song for us so we can play it?
Well, coming back to the Brooklyn Folk Festival this year is Jerron Paxton, known as Blind Boy Paxton. He's actually played at the Brooklyn Folk Festival each and every year. He's one of our staples and really a wonderful performer. Why don't we hear a live recording from the festival of Jerron Paxton playing a song called The Catfish Blues. It's a great one.
Well, I wish I was a catfish swimming way down in the deep blue sea. I'd have all these good-looking women, Lord, fishing after me, fishing after me, Lord, fishing after me. While I went to my baby's house and I sat down on her step, she said, come on in, daddy, my husband just now left, Lord. Baby's house, and I sat down beside her door. I say, I leave so soon in the morning, your man never know. Black, you see the berries, you know the doggone sweet of the juice. It takes brown skin woman for my particular use, Lord. Take rocks and then take a lot of gravel and show building solid road. Take fine brown skin, Lord, satisfy my soul.
Catfish Blues, thanks, Eli, for bringing it along. Before we let you go, one more time, will you give us the information on the exercising the NSA Titan Point building on April 15th, and also give us the website on the Brooklyn Folk Festival?
Sure. Here's all the information. So please come out and join us to exercise the NSA building on Saturday, April 15th. We'll be there at noon. Actually, we're starting at 11:30 a.m. in Foley Square and having a procession, a march from Foley Square to 33 Thomas Street. So we'll start out around 11:30 in Foley Square and be at Titan Point facility there at noon on April 15th. People can check out the website exorcisethenSA.blogspot.com for all the information and updates about that protest action. And then, just a couple of weeks later, please join us for the Brooklyn Folk Festival. As I mentioned, 40-plus bands, workshops, film screenings, everything, and the ticket price is very reasonable. So you can check out brooklynfolkfest.com for all the information, schedule, tickets there at brooklynfolkfest.com. So we hope to see you at both of those events.
What day does the Folk Fest start?
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 28th, 29th, and 30th, and that's going to be at St. Anne's Church which is a beautiful venue in downtown Brooklyn, Brooklyn Heights area there. Very easy to get to. Hope to see you there.
Eli Smith, thanks once again for joining us and telling us about these events.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be on Law and Disorder, my favorite show.
Excellent. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Eli. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Donald Trump's nominee to head the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, was recently sued by the Center for Media and Democracy to force the release of emails exposing ties with fossil fuel backers and the Oklahoma Office of Attorney General. The suit seeks an emergency injunction to prevent Pruitt from destroying any documents relevant to the group's open records requests before his confirmation hearing. Since 2015, the center filed 7 records requests with Pruitt's office, seeking communications with Koch Industries and other coal, oil, and gas corporations, as well as the corporate-funded Republican Attorney General's Association. Pruitt has yet to turn over a single document, despite acknowledging that his office has 3,000 emails and other documents relevant to the initial request. The Oklahoma Open Records Act provides that, quote, the people are vested with the inherent right to know and be fully informed about their government, so they may efficiently and intelligently exercise their inherent political power. The act also mandates that a public body, quote, must provide prompt, reasonable access to its records. With Pruitt seeking confirmation to become EPA administrator, these records are essential for the U.S. Senate to do its job. Joining us to talk about the lawsuit is Arne Pearson, General Counsel and Policy Advisor from the Center for Media and Democracy. Arne Pearson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we start talking about the lawsuit, can you give us a brief overview of what the Center for Media and Democracy does?
Sure. The Center for Media and Democracy is a nonpartisan watchdog that conducts investigation into corporate influence in government and corruption.
Tell us a bit about this lawsuit seeking Scott Pruitt's emails.
So we have filed, over the last 2 years, we filed 9 open records requests with Scott Pruitt's office to get his emails with fossil fuel companies and other polluters. And have just been stonewalled for the entire time. So in January this year, we decided, once we saw Pruitt stonewalling the Senate as well, we decided it was time to take some action, and we filed a lawsuit to compel him to produce the documents. He was in violation of the state's Open Records Act, which requires prompt and reasonable access to government documents.
Do you have an idea of how many emails might be involved?
Yeah, thousands. Just on the first request, which we had filed in January of 2015, the Attorney General's office had identified 3,000 responsive emails, and it took a couple rounds to get them to release those. The first time around, they only turned over 411, saying that was the complete request, complete response. But we went back into court and got an order for them to turn over the rest. It was another over 7,000 pages of documents we received. And, and that's just the first request. That's covering the time period of 2013 to the beginning of 2015. Yeah, we had 8 other requests covering the period between then and now. So there's a lot there, and a lot that was hidden from the public and from the Senate.
So you actually did look at those 3,000 emails?
Yes.
And what kind of information was in them?
Yeah, what we find is, similar to what we saw in the New York Times when they ran an investigative series in 2014. But a lot of coordination, very close coordination with the polluters that his office should be regulating on everything from having them draft letters to the EPA to protest rules that he then submitted under his name, to coordination for setting up meetings and events with energy industry lawyers and other officials, and a lot of communications with ALEC and other Koch-funded groups.
Oh, yes, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Committee.
And Koch-funded means the Koch brothers, yes, who are big fossil fuel industrials. Let's follow the dollar here, Arne. How much money did Pruitt get from these polluters?
Well, you know, over the years, he's received $350,000 in campaign contributions from fossil fuel companies, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. Most of the money goes to a group called RAGA, which is the Republican Attorneys General Association. It's a pay-to-play operation similar to ALEC, just like ALEC is a dating service for corporate interests and legislators. RAGA brings attorneys general together with corporations that want to influence their agenda, and they kick in a lot of money, which then gets spent on the attorney general's reelection campaigns. So since 2014, fossil fuel companies have kicked in more than $4 million to RAGA.
So if Attorney General did some kind of pig thing, that Attorney General shouldn't be worried because he may lose a couple of donations, but he's going to get it back from these big polluters like the Koch brothers. Is that right?
That's right.
Has this happened before where your organization has made open records requests and not received responses?
Yeah, actually it happens quite a bit, and it happens a lot with Attorneys General. We've been trying for the last couple years to get more information about the communications between attorneys general and special interests and corporations, and it's been pretty difficult in a number of states, and we are considering litigation in a couple others.
Did Pruitt mislead the Senate about his use of personal mail?
He did. He told the committee that he did not use a private email account. But both the emails that we found showed a number of uses of personal email. And then since then, there have been two other press outfits that have reported the same thing based on requests that they had done to the office. There was a Fox News outlet in Oklahoma that found the use of personal email, and Associated Press out of Chicago, I believe.
I think I read that Pruitt recently told senators to file more open records requests to answer something like 19 outstanding questions from his confirmation hearing.
He wouldn't answer the questions?
Right. Have you ever seen that kind of behavior before?
No, it's pretty outrageous. I'm not going to answer your questions. Go file your own open records request, even though we haven't turned over a single page in 2 years to anybody who's filed a request. That was the last straw that prompted us to file a lawsuit. It's when we saw his answers to the Senate committee, we were like, they'd sort of been stringing us along, saying, you're next in line, and we're going to get you documents soon. At that point, we realized they're never going to give us anything. So that's when we went to court.
Is this a fantasy on my part, Arne, or could Pruitt be criminally prosecuted?
Well, it depends on what you're asking about. The judge in the first hearing, the district judge, found that the office was in gross violation of the Open Records Act, and there is a misdemeanor to do intentional violations of the Open Records Act. So on that end, it's not really a criminal matter. I mean, you know, there could be substantial penalties involved down the road. I think the bigger question that people need to look out for is a matter of conflicts of interest. And so to the extent that there's any potential criminal liability, I'd say it's looking down the road. If Pruitt conceals his relationships and his ties and his conversations with energy CEOs and their lawyers and then takes official action at the EPA without disclosing that, then I think you're running into serious ethics violations. And that's certainly what we were trying to get at prior to his confirmation, is to get out on the table how close his relationship is with the polluters that he's now responsible to regulate.
It's unfortunately all too familiar a theme with this new administration.
Especially with what Trump did last week with his executive order, giving the green light to all these coal companies to release CO2 into the air. Hundreds of thousands of tons of CO2.
Yeah, it's true. And, the really unfortunate here, is, to put it mildly, is that Pruitt, now the administrator of the EPA, sued the agency 14 times when he was an attorney general, 13 of those times in coordination with the private industries that were being regulated to overturn those rules, including the Clean Power Plan. And now he's in the position of being able to unravel it from inside.
Yes, it is astonishing. Where does the case stand right now procedurally?
We won the release of the documents on the first of our 9 requests. There are over 1,600 pages that the AG's office claimed a privilege for and turned over to the court. And the next step on those is to see what kind of arguments they're presenting for withholding those documents and try and get them released. Those are probably the most telling documents of what they released, but right now they're lodged in court and we haven't been able to see them. In terms of the rest of the requests, the Attorney General's office went to the state Supreme Court and asked for an emergency stay, and they got it. That means we can move ahead, when we are moving ahead with our underlying lawsuit to force the release of the documents. But in terms of the emergency response that the court had been giving us for prompt release, that is all on stay, pending appeal. So I guess long-winded way of saying we don't expect that we're going to get any more documents anytime soon. It will probably take several months, six months or more to get this through the courts on the normal schedule.
Gloria Steinem said at the Women's March that Trump found a fox for every hen house. she sure could have been talking about Pruitt with that observation. One of the things that I learned recently that really upset me is about Chaco Canyon in the Four Corners area in New Mexico. The ancient Native Americans, they lived there 1,000 years ago. They built apartment buildings that were 5 stories high. They had an extremely sophisticated agricultural and irrigation system. And the ruins are there. They're still there. You can go over there and see them. The EPA is now green-lighted fracking in Chaco Canyon. What do you think you guys can do with your lawsuit with respect to exposing Pruitt?
Well, I think we will get the emails at some point. It's just going to take longer than we had hoped. And with those emails, we will be able to shine a light on Pruitt's cozy relationship with the polluters he's now regulating. And I think that will do two things. It will help show what the industry has been pushing for behind the scenes, although we know a lot of that, but it'll show the level of coordination with it, which then creates conflicts of interest. To the extent that we can establish that Pruitt was coordinating with the industry prior to becoming head of the EPA, he should have to recuse himself from those regulatory matters.
We agree. Arne Pearson, how can our listeners learn more about the work of the Center for Media and Democracy?
We have a couple of websites, and the one I would recommend that people go to is exposedbycmd.org, which is where we put up our investigations as we complete them. So when we find emails and other revelations, that's where we put things up.
And I'm curious, when you get these emails, how long does it take to go through them and look for these kernels of impropriety?
It's a lot of work, but I have to say that the research crew is amazingly efficient at it at this point. And we often collaborate with other groups. So in this case, with environmental allies who are concerned about these things, so there's more than one set of eyes going through the documents, and that helps speed things up. So we're often able within a day or two to start publicizing some of the more compelling findings.
Okay, so let me just make sure we got that right. Exposedbycmd.org?
Yes.
Great. Arne, it was lovely to meet you.
Even if over the air.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, it's great. We've been talking with Arne Pearson, who's the General Counsel and Policy Advisor from the Center for Media and Democracy. Arne, a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.